Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 1. Just who is this Patriarch Judah? Watchman's Teaching Letter, Number 13, May 1999. From the 1999 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emmaheiser. Read by Dan Adams. Introductory Note. Much of what follows concerns real history that is usually scoffed at by the establishment, considered myths and fables. They will say that what follows is spurious history. To which we may answer, no, it is you that are spurious. As usual, our response is and shall ever be, consider the sources, and what possible reasons they could have for oppressing the truth. Since, let's be perfectly honest, folks, nobody at any time in history dares write something that is in turn handed down and so copied, and certainly not by any in our race, if it weren't for telling the truth of matters rather than making up myths and stories, which frankly, folks, is all our enemies have going for them. If the scoffers are the usual suspects from among our enemies, they deserve no further esteem and our double curse. This is the 13th in a series of teaching letters. In the last teaching letter, the 12th, I showed you the true meaning of Daniel 7, verses 24 and 25. I brought much documentation concerning how Justinian subdued three nations and how he codified and modified the former Roman laws. I further showed how the Roman Church adopted Justinian's laws and enforced them upon the laity for a prophesied period of 1260 years. While most of the continent of Europe was suffering under the Justinian law codes, Britain was under an entirely different type of law. With this lesson, we will explore that kind of law Britain employed, along with its origin. Also with this lesson, we will be getting into areas few teachers wish to contemplate or talk about when they consider Judah. This lesson is going to fit hand in glove with Lesson 12. Again, I will remind you in advance, this lesson has everything to do with Judah. Now continuing the topic. Just who is this Patriarch Judah? Part 13. With this lesson, we are going to get into the history of the Zara branch of Judah, sometimes spelled Z-A-R-A, or the usual Z-E-R-A-H. Unless this history is learned, you will arrive at many false conclusions of Scripture. There are multitudes who don't know this history, and as a natural result, many are under strange delusions on many passages of Scripture. Examples of these will be discussed later. To get a favorable beginning on this subject, I am going to quote from the book Father Abraham's Children by Parry Edwards Powell, Ph.D., pages 98 through 101. Let us put it in a different way. Here is the beginning of royalty. What else does scepter mean? Judah led in the conquest of Canaan and received the first and choicest portion. David raised it to preeminence over the tribes and the nations. He is the first king of the Judah-Perez line, and he did not appear for several hundred years. Was there and is there an older line of royalty? The answer is yes. The Judah-Zera was royal from the beginning. The true royalties are now merged and have been for centuries in the British royal house. And how long shall we have royalty? Until Shiloh comes. The future Shiloh came to Bethlehem, the first advent, and will come again as Shiloh at the end of time, the second advent. Shiloh is peace, tranquility. Royalty is eternal. The throne of David is everlasting. There is no royalty in Europe, but descends from Judah. And the Judah-Zerah royalty is, we repeat, 700 years older than Judah-Perez, because it began at once. You can read Genesis 38 to see how royalty began, but there is much more to talk about. Another great event is recorded in Genesis 46:12, if we dare mention it. Here we can read the census of those of the family of Jacob who went with him into Egypt, eventually into Egyptian bondage, though they did not know it at the time. Perez took with him his two sons. Zerah went alone. No son accompanied him. Zerah's sons are listed at 1 Chronicles 2:6 as Zimri and Ethan and Haman and Calcol and Dara, five of them in all. We will see where the son later traveled. Here is the inference and the conclusion. The Trojan Welsh bypassed the Egyptian captivity and all other captivities and have never been in slavery to any man in any land at any time. Zerah's son Ethan, very wise, and indeed this line of Judah Zerah is the only royal line termed wise. On the other hand, perhaps going with his father into Egypt but not staying there, he, Ethan, led his people north from Egypt where he was born into what is now Asia Minor, and his son Mahol, M-A-H-O-L, continued likewise. Mahol's heir, Darda, Ethan's grandson and Zerah's great-grandson, reached the western shore where, on a commanding site, he, Darda, founded the metropolis of Troy. The date is 1520 B.C. Here the city flourished for nearly 400 years to around 1120 B.C. Darda first saw the straits that separated Europe and Asia and gave them his name, Dardanelles. Darda also founded a fort here that is named after him. But the greatest honor is recorded in the Bible. Solomon was wiser than all men, than Darda, the son of Mahol. Thus great was the founder of Troy, and the sire of the Trojan race, whose children abide with us still. Troy fell because her sons had an eye for the refined and beautiful in women. Her descendants have that exquisite eye still, and are naturally very proud of the accomplishment. When Troy fell, she did so to arise on another shore in eternal and imperial splendor. I am not referring to Italy. That empire, though long, was ephemeral, short-lived. Italy is an interlude only. Aeneas, a member of the old royal family, attained the kingship, led the saddened Trojans around the Mediterranean, as graphically described in the Aeneid, and finally brought them to their new home on the Tiber in Italy. Including this Italian interlude, the Trojan period embraced 417 years. Here on the Tiber happened a very sad event, too sad to be recalled and would not be except for its denouement, final outcome. Brutus was one day hunting with his father, Silvius, when he spied the prey, as he thought, and let fly an arrow. On running up, he was shocked and grieved to find he had killed his own father. Some people then as now were censorious, and Brutus, some called Brutus Silvius, departed from the new colony, from which later sprang Rome, and with his royal followers went to Greece, rallied the enslaved Trojans, defeated King Pandrasus, thus erasing the defeat of Troy, and as victor exacted three terms. He must give his daughter Ignoe for wife, furnish a big fleet of ships fully provisioned for his emigrant force of 7,000 men, and free permission for them to sail unmolested. Brutus, now with an object and direction, steered west through the Straits of Hercules, then northward along the East Atlantic main, across the English Channel to the present River Dart, and up its stream to Totnes, where stepping on a large stone he landed on the great island which was ever to bear his name as a memorial among the proud nations of the world. This rock, more famous throughout the centuries than Plymouth Rock, is marked as Brutus Rock, and has been visited perennially by people of all nations, all ranks, and all ages. With his people, he, Brutus ap Silvius, explored the whole island, and he apportioned to each one according to his rank and service. At last, he decided the proper place for his capital, a choice bank of the Thames River, so named for a stream, Thiamis, in Epirus, from which he first sailed. And there he built his metropolis, and according to the advice of the oracle, named it Tri Novantum, New Troy. This name it bore for over 1,100 years, before King Lud, at the beginning of the Christian era, built her walls and renamed her Ludden, Lud's Wall, easily refined into London. London is also derived by some from Yamding, meaning sacred eminence. London dates from 350 years before Rome. Why should Rome be called the Eternal City? Note on dates. Powell gives the founding of what eventually became London as occurring some 350 years prior to the founding of Rome, in 753 BC, which would make the founding of London around 1100 BC. Troy, Powell says, goes back all the way to 1500 BC. This background history sets the stage for the rest of the story of Judah Zarah. When one considers over 3,500 years of history, only a fraction of that history can be conveyed in this series of teaching letters. It just simply cannot all be told in one letter. There isn't enough space here to tell the entire story, but Judah Zarah in Britain had the same Judah Zarah family background as Rome. And I hope you noticed the account mentioned heretofore above, for this is going to play a very important part in this narrative. Although Britain and Rome were Judah Zarah kinsmen brothers, the roles they play in history are at opposite ends of the field, in politics, law, and religion. Judah Zarah was not the only Israelite tribe to settle in Britain, but Judah Zarah was far and away the most important. Because the above history is not very well known, it might be well to read it over several times to get familiar with it, as you would with the Bible. To pick up more of the story, I will now quote from the book Father Abraham's Children by Perry Edward Powell, pages 102 and 3. When Julius Caesar was planning the invasion of Great Britain in 55 BC, he reveals to us the quandary that he was in and the relationship of the Roman and the Briton. In truth, we Romans and Britons have the same origin, since both are descended from the Trojan race. Our first father after the destruction of Troy was Aeneas, theirs Brutus, whose father was Silvius, the son of Ascanius, the son of Aeneas. We must send them word, for fear we should violate the ancient nobility of our father Priam by shedding the blood of our kinsmen. Why have we never been taught this in any school? Powell's book is exceedingly rare. It would be among the more worthwhile books to reprint, with current archaeological data included where obtainable. Rome and Britain are at variance in their primitive history. Rome always emphasizes the story of Romulus and Remus, who, bereft of their own mother and cast into the flooded Tiber, were rescued by a she-wolf, who took them to her den and played the mother act. A woodpecker also carried them dainties from her store. Thus their lives were preserved for the great benefit of humanity. This delectable bit from the far past is in our histories and schoolrooms as something to be remembered. It is enough to say that we have nothing so savory in the ancient past of Old Britain. Perhaps that is the reason that our schools pass over the founding of the British Empire by Trojan Welsh. But sometime the whole story will be written and told. Of course, earlier Powell said of the Romans that theirs was a temporary empire, implying that the later British Empire would be permanent, not understanding that empire, in and of itself, as it invariably involves other races, is the beast problem. Brutus reigned praiseworthily for 24 years. Then Britain was divided as today. Locrin, the eldest son, received the choicest portion, England, for 1,500 years called Logria. Camber inherited the western division called after his name Cambria, now Wales. And Albanacht, the rest or northern portion, drew, then and even now, spoken of as Albany or Albania, now Scotland. Locrin was the overking. Locrinus reigned 10 years after his father Brutus and married Gwendolen, Princess of Cornwall, who reigned as queen of the Britons for another 15 years after Locrinus died. Then their son Madden ruled for 40 years, into the time corresponding to that of Samuel and Homer. Prior to Brutus, there is a history stretching back to just after the flood of Noah's time, claiming that Samothis, or Dis, son of Japheth, son of Noah, was the first to settle in Britain, as far back as 2074 BC. This being the era of the hunters, there certainly remains a good deal of hunting left to do. The great work of Brutus is with us today, Lord Chief Justice Cope of England affirms. The original laws of the land were composed of such elements that Brutus first selected from the ancient Greek and Trojan institutions. And in the same strain, writes Lord Chancellor Fortescue, so the kingdom of Britain had its origin from Brutus of the Trojans, who attended him from Greece and Italy, and wove a mixed government compounded of the regal and the democratic. The Roman writers and travelers, after much experience, admit that Britons, Cimbri, had laws that excellent their own, and were highly skilled in agriculture. The extraordinary similarity that exists between many of our early laws, says Yeatman, and those of the Israelites might raise an inference that they were copied from them after the introduction of Christianity, but positive evidence exists of their pre-existence. The common law is identical in principle with what was known as the law of the Lord as given in the books of Exodus. The British system of law is superior to any other European system, although several countries were more benefited by Rome. We wonder how. Britain's laws. From all of this, we can see, while most of the continent of Europe struggled under Roman law, which was later codified by Justinian, Britain was thriving on laws based on the laws of Yahweh. For more on British law, I am going to quote from Celt, Druid, and Chaldee by Isabel Hill Elder, pages 25, 49, and 72. Another point on which Britain differs from other countries is that she has ever maintained the common law, which holds a person under trial innocent until proven guilty, whereas the continental nations maintain the civil law of Justinian, which holds him guilty until proven innocent. That the Britons adopted anything they thought good from the Romans is perfectly true. They did not, however, abandon any of their old essential laws and customs, and still less their religion. But it is untrue to say that the Britons had no previous civilization of their own, as it is to pretend that Roman laws and customs permanently established themselves in Britain and remained after the legions were withdrawn. There is sufficient evidence to prove that the ancestors of the British, centuries before the Romans, gained a footing in these islands, were a polished and intellectual people, skilled in arms as well as in learning, with a system of jurisprudence of their own, superior even to the laws of Rome. Cossack says that the whole system of government and legislation was patriarchal, indicative of an Eastern origin, and that in the Brehon laws, said to be the oldest code of laws in Europe, there are evidences which look very like a trace of Jewish, Judah-Zerah tradition. Another writer affirms that the Brehon Code, in parts, is a republication of the Mosaic Law, which declared that the firstborn of every creature, including the firstborn of man, was to be presented to the Lord. Exodus 13:2, Numbers 18:15. In this connection, it is interesting to note that the Welsh call the Irish Idu, and the country Iduwan, or Jews' land. Camden gives a quotation from Postelius' lecture on Pomponius Mela, a first century writer. Ireland was called Jurin, J-U-R-I-N, quasi Jews' land, because in the distant past, the Judahites of Israel, who were great soothsayers, knew that the future empire of the world would come to these parts. The Psalter of Cashel says, "The Tuatha De Danann, from the tribe of Dan, ruled in Ireland for about 2 centuries and were highly skilled in architecture and other arts from their long residence in Greece." Sir Henry Maine observed, "We who are able here to examine coolly the ancient Irish law in an authentic form see that it is a very remarkable body of archaic law, unusually pure from its origin." We should be beginning to get a pretty well-rounded out picture in our minds of the great difference between Justinian's law codes and Britain's law codes. For a little more history on this, I'm going to return to the book Father Abraham's Children by Perry Edwards Powell, pages 104 and 5. In the course of chronology, for I am following the royal line in its descent and great achievements, we come to the great lawgiver, which is a rarity among the people of the world. His name is Dinwall Mulmud, or in the Latin, Dunwallu Amalmutius, and he is often referred to by the historian who is acquainted with the history of Britain before the advent of the Anglo-Saxon. He reduced the whole island of Great Britain to his sway, as his ancestor Brutus had done, and during his long reign of 40 years gave them a distinguished code of laws named for him, the Malmutian Laws. He is buried in Trinovantum, now London. Shakespeare has enshrined his glory thus: "Malmutius made our laws, who was the first of Britain which did put his brow within a golden crown and called himself a king." Just 3 reigns later came one who achieved even greater fame and longer service, and she was a woman, the queen of Gwaethelin, Barus. Her name is Queen Martia, the author of the famous Martian Laws, which centuries later, by only making the necessary changes for time and place, were adopted by Alfred the Great and are the basis for the present English laws. Then what shall be the praises of Queen Martia? Why is not she equally famous? It is evident from all we have investigated thus far, the laws of Rome under Justinian and the ancient laws of Britain were and are as different as day is from night. Not only are the laws of these two different, but the religions of the two are 180 degrees apart. I really don't like to use the term religion, unless it refers to paganism, and for Rome the term religion fits quite well. Obviously, the destinies of Rome are about to collide, and it's a big subject. Britain's religion. To get started with this phase of the study, I am going to quote again from the book Father Abraham's Children by Perry Edwards Powell, pages 140 and 142. Now we come to the missionary movement of Joseph of Arimathea, who was appointed by Philip the Apostle. After the passion of his nephew, Jesus Christ, persecution fell heavily upon the infant church. The Jew and the Roman were bitter persecutors, but he, Joseph of Arimathea, knew where there was no persecution but protection. However, he was seized, and since the Jew could not kill under the law directly, he and Lazarus and Mary and Martha, his sisters, Mary Magdalene, Marcella, Maximum, and others, all objects of especial Jewish hostility, were exposed to the sea in a vessel without sail or oars. They drifted to Marseille, southern Gaul, where they arrived in a famished condition. The Arimathean knew the territory and friendly traders and was aided on his way, the destination of which was now Britain. Here they eventually arrived and came to rest in Yenis Avalon, Glastonbury, where he rested and soon began his labors for his nephew. The year was 37 AD. On his tomb is the epitaph, Ad Britonos veni post Christum sepelivi, docui quievi, I came to the Britons after I had buried the Christ. I taught, I have entered on my rest. When he, Joseph of Arimathea, began, St. Paul was still in Arabia preparing for his mission. Joseph preached in Britain from 37 to 76 AD. King Arviragus decreed the perpetual exemption from taxation of the 12 plows or hides of land on which his first mission stood. Thus, Britain has the second congregation and the first Christian church building in the world. The mother church of Christianity was Jerusalem, and it met in the upper room, and the pagan church at Rome was not yet organized. The first apostle to visit the island was Simon Zelotes, after he had preached the gospel across Africa, Spain, and into Britain, where he was crucified by the Romans. Coming at about the same time was Aristobulus, the brother of Barabbas, the father of Peter's wife, and the first bishop of Britain. He was sent by Paul. Arwith Still, Wales, commemorates him. I am sure there are many who have never heard this particular story of Joseph of Arimathea, and fewer yet understand its importance. For more insight on Joseph of Arimathea, I will quote The Traditions of Glastonbury by E. Raymond Capt, page 22. Several ancient manuscripts indicate that after the Passion of Christ, Joseph of Arimathea was commissioned by St. Philip the Apostle to take the gospel to Britain. One such manuscript is The Victory of Aurelius Ambrosius by Gildas Albanicus. It asserts plainly that Britain received the gospel in the time of Emperor Tiberius, and that Joseph was sent, with others, after the dispersion of the disciples to Britain by St. Philip. There, Joseph was to lay the foundation of the Christian religion. The author gives the date about the year of our Lord 63, and adds that Joseph stayed in Britain the rest of his life. Notice that this mission occurred before the destruction of Jerusalem and the scattering of the Jews in 70 AD. Another manuscript, The Antiquities of Glastonbury, contains this entry in the opening chapter, St. Philip, coming into the country of the Franks to preach, converted to the faith and baptized them, working to spread Christ's word, he chose 12 from among his disciples and sent them into Britain. Their leader, it was said, was St. Philip's dearest friend, Joseph of Arimathea, who buried the Lord. Translated from De Antiquit Glastonbenensis Ecclesia, 1240. We can see from this that outside of a few at Jerusalem, the gospel was first preached in Britain. This brings up one of the most misunderstood, one of the most misrepresented, and one of the most misquoted passages of Scripture in the Bible. Almost everyone misunderstands it and has a twisted conception of its meaning. The scripture is Romans 1:16, which reads, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to every one that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek." First of all, it's not talking about Canaanite, quote-unquote, Jews here. It's speaking of the Judahites in Britain. And they got the gospel message first, just as it says. it should say, to the tribe of Judah in Jerusalem and in Britain first, and also the Greek. And they were all Israelites and nothing but Israelites. It was through Judah in Britain that the gospel message was sent to all the other Israelite tribes. The few of Judah at Jerusalem at this time is hardly worth mentioning. Up to this point, we understand that Britain was populated mostly by Zarah-Judah. We understand that Britain had a different code of laws than Rome. And we understand that Britain was the first nation to receive the gospel. As a matter of fact, the Church of Rome was never recognized by our Redeemer except as being a whore. The Roman Catholic Universal Church was never the true church for even one day. She was never the true church for 1 hour. She was never the true church for 1 minute. She was never the true church for 1 second or a division thereof. Britain was the true church, and Rome was the counterfeit church. If you can trace your theology through Rome, you are part of the whore system. Because of the two theologies, there would be an ongoing war between Britain and Rome until after approximately 1,000 years, the true church established in Britain would be completely subdued by the Roman religious system up to the Reformation. But the Reformation left us with the conglomerate of fractionalized divisions, and that is the reason we have today so many denominations, each with its own doctrine. The 1,000-year reign of the true church lasted from about 37 AD until about 1172 AD, when the last remaining church in Ireland came under the domination of Rome. This was the church millennium as spoken of in Revelation 26. If you are looking for a future millennium, it is already past, and Satan, the quote-unquote Jews, have been loosed out of his prison, the ghettos, to deceive the nations, called the United Nations. Revelation 27. The idea of a future millennium is a Canaanite, quote-unquote Jewish, satanic doctrine. Forget it! If the millennium is future, then the prophesied attack, Revelation 27 through 8, of Gog and Magog on the United States and elsewhere, is 1,000 years plus in the future, while Russia and China pose a threat to us at this very hour. If the Gog and Magog attack is that far in the future, let's forget about Russia and China for the time being. We will now investigate the fighting between Rome and Britain during these early years. The true church, Britain, versus the false church, Rome. We have never been taught the early history of Britain for obvious reasons. It would easily overturn many false conceptions, such as that Christianity came to Ireland first through Roman church missionaries and later spread to quote-unquote pagan Britain. This is a very clever lie. Like being told lies? Then pay attention to their schools and scholars, all liars with a universalist, commercial, quote-unquote Jewish agenda behind them. Continuing with Clifton. To get started on the history of the fight between Rome and Britain, I am again going to quote from the book Father Abraham's Children by Perry Edwards Powell, pages 105 and 7. At the dawn of the Christian era, the dark shadow on the horizon was Rome. What would be her attitude? Really, the Cimbri provided the attack according to both Caesar and the Druidic triads. In the day of Caesar, the Roman proconsul Lucius Valerius Preconius Preconicus was routed by the second silver host of the Cimbri at Tolosa, Aquitania, and the colossal Lucius Manilius lost all of his commissariat food supply and, in addition, ingloriously compelled to retreat. When this stunning news reached Julius Caesar, he turned on the Veneti of Vendeans, those navy had been used by the Cimbri or Britons, and who enjoyed a flourishing trade with Great Britain. This led to the first invasion of the island on the 5th of August of 55 BC. This campaign got only 7 miles into the island, lost one battle, and had the camp attacked by the victorious islanders, a thing unheard of before this time. Caesar was baffled and decamped, determined to return the following year with a mightier force. He wrote later, "The legionary soldiers were not a fit match for such an enemy." Throughout here, we are using the common pronunciation Caesar, when in fact it was actually Caesar, but we use Caesar. The second campaign came the next year and lasted from the 10th of May to the 26th of September, 54 BC, and got as far as 70 miles from shore, when Caesar was compelled to make peace at Guerdlian, or St. Albans, on account of the bad news from the continent as well as the triumphant resistance of the Cimbri. He was royally feasted in London by King Cassibelanus, where Latin prevailed. How could such people be so savage as to not know how to speak Latin in their capital? Caesar left to reconquer Gaul and subdue the Roman Empire for his family. He never returned to Britain. His enemies at Rome taunted him in the words of Lucan. With pride he sought the Britons, and when found, dreaded their force and fled the hostile ground. Now appeared a second war of British independence. It was longer and more stubborn. Rome at this time had consolidated her empire everywhere, in Asia, Africa, and in all Europe. Her boundaries were entirely free of any invading foe. Her whole military force was at her command anywhere she desired. Her population was at this time 120 million people of Caucasian or semi-Caucasian blood. The Caesars were sitting securely upon the throne. Everything was propitious for an easy conquest and a glorious victory. Caligula played the buffoon, and we pass him by. But we must give serious consideration to Emperor Claudius. He acts the part of a very capable leader. Rome had the benefit, sorry to say, of treason on the part of some Reguli of the Britons. Under the emperor were the greatest generals, Plautius, Vespasian, later emperor, his son Titus, who during one battle rescued his father from death, also later an emperor, and Cneius Geta. All were proven by being successful in other campaigns against other peoples. On the defensive side was Guiderius, who fell early, but a very efficient general. Immediately, Carodoc, the Latin, Caractacus, a graduate of the Silurian College at Caerleon un Usk, now Wales, king of the Silures, was unanimously elected Pendragon of all Britain. The Cimbri stubbornly held off the Roman legions so accustomed to victory. Appeals for help reached Emperor Claudius in the imperial city, and he left for the imperiled front with the 2nd and 14th legions, their auxiliaries, and a cohort of elephants, which were designed to break the charges of the Briton chariot with its scythe-attached axle. Claudius negotiated a treaty, a part of which was the marriage of his daughter, Genuisa, to King Arviragus, and he received a triumphant home. Nevertheless, the war continued. In order to see the severity of the fighting in 7 years, there were about 35 battles. Treachery and heroism appeared. You will notice it is a bit hard to follow names here. For instance, let's take the name Caradoc, C-A-R-A-D-O-C. As long as he was not king, his name was Caradoc. But once he took the throne, he was called King Arviragus, being the same person as Caradoc. When Caradoc went to Rome, they Latinized his name to Caractacus, still being the same person. So whether he is called Caradoc, King Arviragus, or Caractacus, it is the same person. See Celt Druid and Cull D by Isabel Hill Elder, page 38, paragraph 4. Caractacus is the next person I am going to talk about, and for that, I will quote from The Origin and Early History of Christianity in Britain by Andrew Gray, D.D., pages 14 through 16. Caractacus, Caractacus. From those valuable historical documents, the Welsh Triads, written originally in the British dialect, it appears that Celadoc, Caractacus, was betrayed and delivered up to the Roman commander by Aregbed about 51 AD and taken to Rome. After Christ, Bran Bernus, his father, Ian Linus, his son, Aragon, a daughter, and Gladys Claudia, a second daughter, were all taken to Rome likewise, and there detained 7 years as hostages of Caractacus. Tacitus, or Tacitus, furnishes an account of the battle which terminated the career of Caradoc in field. Caradoc, seeing that the Romans were victorious and that his own wife and daughter had fallen into the hands of the conquerors, took refuge himself at their repeated solicitations at Caeravoc, York, with Aregved, queen of the Brigantes, and a grandniece of the infamous traitor in the Julian War, Mandobratius of Averwy. Here, by her orders, with hereditary treachery, he, Caradoc, was seized while asleep in her palace, loaded with fetters, and delivered to Ostorius Scapulo. On receiving intelligence of the event, Claudius ordered him and all the captive family to be sent to Rome. The approach and arrival of Caradoc at Rome are finally described by the ancient historians. Roma catenatum tremuit spectare Britannum. Rome trembled when she saw the Britons, though fast in chains. The Senate was convened, and the trial of Caradoc began. With an unaltered countenance, the hero of 40 battles, great in arms, greater in chains, took his position before the emperor and defended himself in the following utterances. Had my government in Britain been directed solely with a view to the preservation of my hereditary domains, or the aggrandizement of my own family, I might have long since entered this city an ally, not a prisoner. Nor would you have disdained for a friend a king descended from illustrious ancestors, and the director of many nations. My present condition, stripped of its former majesty, is as adverse to myself as it is a cause of triumph to you. What then? I was lord of men, horses, arms, wealth. What wonder it? At your dictation I refuse to resign them. Does it follow that because the Romans aspire to universal domination, every nation is to accept the vassalage they impose? I am now in your power. Betrayed, not conquered. Had I, like others, yielded without resistance, where would have been the name of Caradoc? Where is your glory? Oblivion would have buried both in the same tomb. Bid me live. I shall survive forever in history, one example at least of Roman clemency. Such an address as this, worthy of a king, a soldier, a free man, had never before been delivered in the Roman Senate. Tacitus thought it worthy to be reported and immortalized by his pen. The preservation of Caradoc forms a solitary exception in the long catalogue of victims to the policy then in vogue. Nor can it be accounted for, considering the inflexibility of Roman military usage, in any other way than by an immediate and supernatural intervention of Providence, which was leading by the hand to the very place of the British king at Rome, the great apostle of the Israelite nations. The family of Aulus Plautius, a lieutenant in the army of Claudius, was already connected with that of Caradoc, he having married Gladys, Pomponia Gaecina, the sister of Caradoc. Besides, an engagement existed between Gladys Claudia, the daughter of Caradoc, and Rufus Pudens, Pudentius, a young Roman senator of large possessions. But their united influence would not have sufficed to alter a fixed law of the Roman state in favor of an enemy who had tasked its utmost powers and resources for so many years. These names just mentioned should be familiar to you, as they are mentioned in 2 Timothy 4:21. I am sure that millions of people over the years have read this passage and had no idea who the people mentioned were, or that they had a direct connection with the first permanently organized church, the British Church. Let's read it again with a new light on it. Do my diligence to come before winter. Eubulus greeteth thee, and Pudens, and Linus, and Claudia, and all the brethren. This not only proves that Paul had a direct connection with the church in Britain, but proves that Paul was a genuine apostle of Yahshua. It proves that his calling was true. There is a pernicious doctrine going around that Paul was not genuine, but an impostor and a deceiver. I will give you a short history of this anti-Paulism, which was published in pamphlet form by Destiny Publishers, Merrimack, Massachusetts. I'll only quote the first three paragraphs. There is a movement on foot to discredit the writings of the Apostle Paul and the Bible, declaring they are a perversion of the truth. The conclusion is that Paul's epistles should be expunged from the New Testament. This is the objective of a book entitled Who Was Paul of Tarsus by Isabel Upton Van Etten. In this book, a premise is established based upon ifs, surmises, and assumptions, which enable the author to conclude that Paul was in opposition to the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ and was completely out of step with the teachings of the disciples of Jesus. It is a faithful axiom that once a premise is established and accepted, deductions drawn naturally follow. After reading this little book, we are reminded of another book also by a woman author whose name was Mary Baker Eddy, founder of so-called Christian Science. She also established a premise and won the acceptance of a substantial following in support of her conclusions. We pose the question, will many succumb to the propaganda that Paul was subversive and that his writings are unacceptable and should be deleted from the New Testament? Obviously, Isabel Upton Van Etten overlooked 2 Timothy 4:21 and 2 Peter 3:15, where Peter said in his epistle, "Our beloved brother Paul, I presume." Because of this remark, might we have to delete all of Peter's epistles also? Either Paul was a chosen vessel or he was not a chosen vessel, and we might advisably tread very lightly in condemning his commissioned ministry to be unfit, as Paul commissioned Linus, first bishop of Rome. In the Yearbook of Destiny magazine, monthly publication, June 1946, published by Destiny Publishers, Haverhill, Massachusetts, there is an article, Druidism in Britain, by the Reverend L.G.A. Roberts, pages 203 through 208. On page 207 of this article, we find the following information under the subtitle, Christianity in the Isles. It was in AD 52 that the conflict took place between the Romans and British under Caractacus, who so nearly held back the Roman legions from conquering Britain. But he was cruelly betrayed by Cardus Mandua and taken prisoner to Rome. With him as hostages, Bran, his father, his three sons and daughters, were also taken captive. The struggles of this brave people for their liberty filled the streets of Rome with their daring prowess. And about 59, St. Paul was himself a prisoner at Rome, but in his own hired house. Whilst here he, Paul, met with Pudens and Linus and Claudia, and evidently with Eubulus, Aristobulus. Timothy was also with St. Paul, and in the second epistle of St. Paul to Timothy, written a few years after, chapter 4:21, he says, Eubulus greeteth thee and Pudens and Linus and Claudia. Every one of these we find intimately connected with Britain. The prefix EU in Eubulus being of the same meaning in Greek and Aristos, the two names, Romans 16:10 and 2 Timothy 4:21. Aristobulus and Eubulus have been considered to mean the same person. Of this man, we read in the Greek Menologies that St. Paul ordained him as a bishop to the country of the Britons. Another account says that this man died at Glastonbury in 99. Because this is a big subject and covers a lot of territory, it will be necessary to run it in a series of lessons. At the moment, I am not just sure how many lessons it will take to complete it, as it needs to be covered. However long that is, I will continue this subject. At this point, I have only set the stage for some very important things that followed in the British Church, and how, after time, the Roman religious system completely subdued them. End of Watchman's Teaching Letter Number 13. Thank you for listening.